You know, if Mitt Romney wins the Oval Office this week, he'll be the first Mormon president ever. And with that in mind, we thought we'd take a closer look at the Mormon faith by concentrating on the life of Brigham Young, the second president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. John G. Turner, who's assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University, has recently published a biography of Young, and he points out that while most Americans in the mid-1800s would have been past their prime at the age of 50, in 1851, when Brigham Young was that age, he was a man at the top of his game. Not only was he the leader of the Mormons, he'd led his people from Illinois across the Rocky Mountains, helped them survive a couple of difficult first years, was the governor of the territory of Utah, and had gathered a household of some 15 wives. Would you believe he eventually had 55 wives in total? So his accomplishments were utterly improbable for those times, or indeed for any times. John Turner's book is called Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, and he joins me now via Skype from his home in Virginia. John, welcome to our Little Wilders program. Before I ask you to tell all about Brigham, would you be kind enough to tell us who George Mason was?
He is a rather obscure founding father. He was governor of Virginia around the time of the Revolutionary War. So I think when my university was established, they picked an obscure founding father to make it sound very venerable and august.
Okay, well, that's what we're going to be doing tonight, and is talking about once obscure founding fathers. When did you become so fascinated with Mormonism?
I grew up not far from where the religion began back in the early 1800s. I grew up outside of Rochester, New York. Joseph Smith, the founding prophet of Mormonism, once lived around 30 miles from where I grew up. So at some point, I got interested. And then when I was studying the history of American religion, it was hard not to get somewhat fascinated by the Mormons. And it's a story in the 19th century of prophets, persecution, polygamy, has all sorts of drama and color and controversy. So that just drew me into the story.
And of course, your timing is impeccable, John. I must congratulate you on your prescience as an author, as an historian. Why did you decide to focus on Brigham Young rather than, say, Joseph Smith?
Well, probably for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, and maybe most importantly, Brigham Young was a significant and controversial figure in mid-19th century American history more broadly. So he was one of the chief political villains or antagonists of the U.S. government for decades. And so he has an importance that goes beyond the founding of the Mormon Church itself. And also, I didn't want to write about Joseph Smith. If you write about Joseph Smith, you get bogged down in whether or not he actually received these golden plates from an angel and so forth. And with Brigham Young, he was clearly a sincere follower of Joseph Smith, a sincere convert. And you can get into, you know, the practical side of religion making a little bit more fully.
Why did Young desert Methodism? Because he was born in Western New York into a Methodist family.
He was. You know, for whatever reason, it didn't satisfy him. He seemed to not like the emotional nature of Methodist revivals. And for whatever reason, he actually had a conversion to Methodism of sorts and joined a Methodist church as an adult, but he seemed to just be spiritually adrift. I think he was looking for a clearer sense of purpose and direction, and he ultimately found it in Mormonism.
He wasn't into miraculous healing like the Methodists or the emotional camp meeting revivals.
Well, you know, he later talked about how he didn't like the emotional nature of the revivals with people rolling and thumping and bawling and things like that. But he was very much into what you might call supernatural gifts, including healing. And in particular, he was a frequent practitioner of speaking in tongues, something that would be associated with Pentecostal Christianity today.
So he converts because Mormonism satisfied a sort of quasi-skepticism.
In a way, what seemed to really get him over the hump was seeing a group of Mormon missionaries speak in tongues. He had encountered the Book of Mormon very shortly after its publication in 1830, and he spent 2 years thinking about this new Bible and this new church. And then when he saw Mormons speaking in tongues, he took it as a clear sign of God's presence and power. And that seemed to overcome his initial hesitation and skepticism.
This is Alan Nell on RN, and I'm talking to John Turner about Brigham Young. It's always been my ambition, John, to get someone speaking in tongues on the program with your connections. Perhaps we can organise that later. We've got to deal with Joseph Smith, so let's do so briefly. How did he come to publish the Book of Mormon? Tell us about the unfortunately named Angel Moroni and the gold plates.
Well, especially if you don't pronounce it as he did, it's unfortunately named. He pronounced it the Angel Moroni, which sounds a little bit better, I suppose. He later, as he told the story, he first encountered the Angel Moroni in 1823. And Moroni showed him a set of golden plates upon which was written the history of his ancestors. And Moroni, as the Book of Mormon tells, would have lived around the 4th century of the Common Era, so after Christ. Joseph Smith saw the plates, or was shown the plates by Moroni for 4 consecutive years before he took possession of them. He later said that the plates contained writing in what he called Reformed Egyptian. He translated, or maybe more accurately, dictated through supernatural means what became the Book of Mormon, which was then published in 1830.
How does the Book of Mormon differ fundamentally from other sacred texts, well, say from the New Testament accounts?
Well, there's a couple of things that are very distinctive about the Book of Mormon, especially if you compare it to the Christian Old and New Testament. First of all, it's very much written in the language of the King James Bible. It very much reflects, I think, the linguistic influence of the King James. Secondly, it is very Christocentric. So whereas you have a Christian Old Testament that is not obviously about Christ, the entirety of the Book of Mormon is very much about Christ. It tells the story of a family of Jews that left Israel almost 600 years before the birth of Christ. And then Jesus ultimately appears to that family's descendants in the New World.
So is there there's an argument, as I understand, that we're talking about one of the famous lost tribes?
Yes, and Americans in the early 1800s were very fascinated with stories of the lost tribes of Israel and their potential destinations. According to the Book of Mormon, it's not so much a lost tribe as one family that flees Israel and takes refuge in the New World.
Yeah, not lost at all. Okay, now what was different about Mormonism? What was it offering that other forms of radical evangelicalism weren't?
Well, it started off, in my view, as a very idiosyncratic or unusual form of what you could call Protestant Restorationism. There were a lot of American evangelical Protestants who wanted to restore the purity and practices of the New Testament church. Joseph Smith initially just named his church the Church of Christ, and there were a few other churches of Christ around at the time. Ultimately, Joseph Smith goes in a different direction. He talks about not just restoring the New Testament church, but the ancient order of all things. And so whereas other restorationist Protestants might focus on restoring the spiritual gifts of the New Testament or church leadership as it existed among the earliest Christians, Joseph Smith ultimately restores a priesthood, builds temples, and most controversially, perhaps, institutes plural marriage.
This raises the issue of polygamy. How did that become part of the faith?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. If you know, the Orthodox Mormon position is that it's something that God commanded through Joseph Smith of righteous men in the church. And at some point, Joseph Smith began taking plural wives. People argue a great deal about whether or not the taking of plural wives came before Joseph Smith's revelation or afterwards. What is clear is that Joseph Smith began teaching this to his close followers in the early 1840s, including Brigham Young. And after an initial period of hesitation, Brigham Young ultimately embraces this practice wholeheartedly.
Tell us about the murder, perhaps the martyrdom of Joseph Smith. Who killed him, where, and why?
An anti-Mormon mob broke into a jail in Illinois and shot Joseph Smith and his brother. He had been arrested for ordering the destruction of a printing press. And it was a printing press that was being used by dissident members of his own church. Members who were upset about polygamy and upset about a few other things as well. And so he's arrested. He actually chooses to be arrested instead of fleeing. And then while he's in jail, a group of anti-Mormons break into the jail cell and shoot him, and he falls out of the window and is dead.
My guest is John G. Turner from George Mason University, and we're talking about his biography of Brigham Young, the second president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Why was Brigham Young up for the job?
I think first and foremost, he'd risen through the ranks of the church hierarchy through his steadfast and fervent loyalty to Joseph Smith. There were multiple times at which the church nearly collapsed in the late 1830s, and many people, including Joseph Smith's close followers, lost their faith in him. But Brigham Young doesn't waver, and so by 1844, which is when Joseph Smith is murdered, he is very close to Joseph Smith. He has stood by his side as new rituals have been introduced in the 1840s. Polygamy, baptism for the dead, the endowment ceremony.
Well, he was certainly very ardent on polygamy, because you record that he set a world record of 55 wives. Now, why did the Mormons have to keep moving from place to place, from Ohio to Missouri to Illinois? Persecution or looking for a more promising land?
Persecution, and it wasn't primarily because of their theology, and it wasn't at this time because of controversies over polygamy. It's because Joseph Smith called on his followers to gather together. And wherever the Mormons gathered together, they aroused political opposition from non-Mormons, because they quickly became the dominant numerical force in any city or county. And then their neighbors didn't want to cede power to them, and they organized mobs to drive them out.
I was surprised to discover from your book that a group, a religion, which now seems so spectacularly affluent, has its origins in grinding poverty, that very often the acolytes, the recruits, were from the most pitiful economic circumstances.
Sure. Well, and that described both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. You know, their families moved around, never held on to any land, never got ahead. And so it very much was a religion of the downtrodden.
And at what point did their economic circumstances started to change?
For the church as a whole, things really move forward beginning many years later, many decades later, in the early 1900s. Once the church abandons polygamy and theocracy and reconciles itself with the United States, it's then that Mormons become enthusiastic capitalists and experience more prosperity.
I have to interpose this because it's something which comes to mind, given the current contest between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, and that is the church's rather problematic attitudes historically towards black people.
Sure. Yes, it's an interesting part of the dynamic. As I'm sure you know from the question, the LDS Church, as it's frequently called, Latter-day Saint Church, ordains all of its male members in good standing into the priesthood. And there were a few black men who were ordained into the priesthood under Joseph Smith. But Brigham Young took the position that African Americans, or really black people, anyone of African descent, was cursed, labored under a divine curse, could not hold the priesthood. And the church maintained that policy until 1978. So what that meant was that any black people...
I'm sorry, until 1978?
1978.
Wow. That's remarkable given the dynamics of American politics at a rather earlier era.
It is remarkable. It wouldn't have been remarkable had the church persisted, say, until the mid-1960s. But 1978 is, you know, 15 years or so after the peak of the civil rights movement, and so that is remarkable.
Have many African Americans flocked to the colors since then?
Not a flock. There's more of a handful or a trickle, and there are far more people of African descent that are members of the church in Central and South America, probably than in the United States itself.
Let's go back to the saga of Brigham Young, the Salt Lake Valley in the west of the U.S., where he led his people following the exodus from Nauvoo. Here's the territory of Utah being created, Brigham Young, the territory's first governor. Tell us about the Utah War.
Well, that was it's a very strange event in American history. In 1857, and this is just a few years before the American Civil War, President James Buchanan sent one-fifth of the U.S. Army to Utah because he suspected that the Mormons, and Brigham Young in particular, were not loyal to the United States. Essentially, once they'd been kicked out of Illinois, Brigham Young wanted to be left alone. He didn't want the U.S. government to interfere with Utah's governance of itself and the church's control of the territory's politics. And so when American officials and soldiers and judges would come out to Utah, Brigham Young tended to make their lives rather uncomfortable, and many of them would go back to Washington with complaints against him. And eventually, Buchanan decides to replace Brigham Young with a non-Mormon governor, and he sends this army to Utah to escort the new governor. And the Mormons decide to resist. And so there's a standoff in the fall of 1857. Eventually, Brigham Young backs down the next spring.
What was the so-called Mountain Meadows Massacre, John?
Mountain Meadows Massacre was the treacherous slaughter of 120 non-Mormon men, women, and children who were passing through Utah on their way to California. And it takes place at the height of tension involved in the Utah War. There's been a lot of controversy since then about whether or not Brigham Young ordered the massacre.
Well, you've done more study on this point than anyone, surely. What do you think?
Well, I don't know if I've done more study on it than anyone, but I spent a lot of time thinking about it. I think ultimately that Brigham Young didn't want to fight the U.S. Army, and so I don't think he specifically ordered the massacre. his strategy was to try to keep the army out of the Salt Lake Valley, and to order the massacre of these non-Mormon pioneers would have simply brought the full fury of the U.S. government down on his church. But I do think that in choosing to resist the army and talking about Indians attacking wagon trains and people being killed, I think he very much created an atmosphere in which Mormons in southern Utah felt that they could do this and that it might be condoned.
In the few minutes we've got left, let me ask you this. Are Mormons overwhelmingly politically conservative, or are there some who might vote for Barack Obama?
Well, the answer to both of those questions is yes. They are overwhelmingly politically conservative. About 80% typically vote Republican, and it may even be a bit higher this year. There's certainly more liberal, politically liberal Mormons, and they'll vote for Barack Obama, but I imagine about 80% will vote for Romney. So he doesn't have to worry about Utah, which he wouldn't have to worry about.
It's anyway. Hardly a swing state.
Yeah, it's very unlikely to swing. And you know, there are a lot of Mormon voters in states like Arizona and Nevada, and they'll probably will give Romney some help there.
I assume, like any other monolithic faith, it's fractured over and over again into all sorts of factions.
That's correct. There were groups in the 19th century that didn't decide to follow Brigham Young after Joseph Smith's murder. There were groups that didn't accept plural marriage. And then there were other groups that didn't accept the abandonment of plural marriage. Mm. The main church that is headquartered in Utah is the overwhelming majority of Latter-day Saints today, though.
How is Brigham Young viewed by modern Mormons?
I think he is still very much viewed as the savior of the people after Joseph Smith's death, and very much admired for the pioneer exodus to Utah. I think most Mormons might allow that he had some rough spots, maybe use some rough and profane language at times. I'm not sure that most would know as much about those rough spots as they might find out in my book.
As a scholar, John, did you find access to the Mormon archives easy or difficult?
That is something that has waxed and waned over the years, and I think I came along at a good time where the church is being much more cooperative with outside scholars. So I had tremendous access, which allowed me, I think, to write a very colorful and dramatic story.
You've certainly done that, and John, thank you very much for your time. John G. Turner, author of Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, and we were talking to John via the clarity of Skype. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you, Philip. My pleasure.
On our next, we'll be back with Bruce Shapiro, and we'll be talking, guess what, about the next president of the United States and perhaps, yes, the first Mormon. See you later. Thank you.